so much reticent of Steve Moore, struggling for the sort of engineering, question mark. So we can expect the invoice would be delivered on fully by a very provocative cause. If you were ever to choose a speaker for immediately after lunchtime, where you may be in danger of falling asleep, Steve is...
Okay. I've got my marching orders here.
So without further ado, let us proceed. And we will try and keep to time as much as we can.
Yes.
Take up some time.
Now, Bill, if I ask you how much time I have, can you subtract from 30 minutes, right, so that there's at least 10 minutes for questions? Is that okay?
30 minutes from what?
You know, so in other words, I'm allowing myself...
I'll give you a clue anyway.
Yeah. Okay. First of all, thanks to Bill and everyone for inviting me. What I want to talk about today is, if you had a chance to read my abstract, you'll begin to see what I'm talking about, which has to do with the relationship between the soul of engineering and intelligent design. Okay. This morning I raised this question to David about what do all these disparate activities that we normally call engineering have in common that makes us want to sort of capture them all under one rubric, one faculty, so forth. In a sense, this is an issue that sort of preoccupies me, and in a way, my talk is in a way a kind of answer, a positive answer to this question, because I don't think it's just an idle term, engineering, that there is a kind of engineering worldview, you might say, that may or may not be present among existing engineers today, but I think historically it's been very important in terms of orienting what engineering is about, in terms of distinguishing it from physics and from other like-minded fields. And it's very closely connected to what the scientific revolution was about. Okay. First, let me start off, since some of the speakers who aren't engineers, and I certainly am one of those people, have done some autobiographical remarks. I should say I'm primarily trained as a historian and philosopher of science. My first exposure, as it were, to engineers as a cultural formation came about when I was a master student at Cambridge in history and philosophy of science in 1979. And at that time, I was the secretary of the Humanist Society. Billy Graham was launching one of his evangelical crusades in Britain, and so he was going to speak in King's College Chapel to all the students assembled and so forth, hoping to get converts and so forth. And attending this kind of crusade were people who were going to defend a kind of creationism that was sort of in fashion back in the late 70s, early 80s. So the person they had brought over at the time was a professor of thermodynamics. Okay, who was an engineer by training, and actually gave, now in retrospect, what sounds to me like an intelligent design style argument, though at that time it was still called creationism. Okay, it basically had to do with issues of the fine-tuning of the universe, and when it wasn't fine-tuned, God would inject some energy to make sure evolution didn't just sort of wind the planet down through endless extinction and death, and you probably know the score. And so what was coming across there was a certain kind of conception of God as the big engineer, okay, who kind of kept it all in equilibrium, kind of gave purpose to everything, that had a kind of overall design, which in a sense you had to understand in the whole, right? That in a sense you can't quite see the design in the parts, you have to see it in the whole. So yes, there's death, there's extinction, there's suboptimality of the various parts, but in the whole there is a kind of point, a kind of purpose. I'm going to say a little bit about this later. This idea of this being the best of all possible worlds, okay, this is part of that tradition, okay, which often I think people who are involved in intelligent design and also people involved in engineering are not quite familiar with. And this has to do with the connection between optimism and optimization as concepts. Okay, optimization, a very important concept in engineering, and it's connected with this sort of general worldview of optimism. And in a sense, this is kind of what I see as tracking engineering as a distinctive mentality. Okay, so that's kind of part of the context. And over the years, as I've gotten more and more involved with the debates over Darwinism and creationism and intelligent design, most notably 4 years ago when I was an expert witness in the Kitzmiller case in Pennsylvania, which was the first direct test case of intelligent design in the classroom, I mean, it just became very clear, and it's become subsequently clear, it's been more involved in this, that a large percentage of the people who support intelligent design theory are engineers. In fact, it might be the major constituency within the sciences broadly understood. Engineers and chemists. Not biologists, especially not biologists who are sort of on the natural history side, the people who as it were, have a training that's comparable to what Darwin's training was. Those people tend not to be intelligent design people. But the people who come from kind of design sciences, broadly conceived, tend to think that something to intelligent design theory. Okay, and that's a very interesting point. So, for example, in the United Kingdom today, probably the most scientifically respectable intelligent design theorist is the professor of thermodynamics at Leeds University, where you used to be, Andrew McIntosh, and he is an expert in the area of biomimetics. Okay, and so this is the idea of using fruits and vegetables and animals as models for things that are of, you know, human value, human significance, that can somehow ameliorate the human condition. So in other words, you regard nature as providing potentially prototypes and templates for things that we might be able to bring and sort of enable us to live better lives. Okay? And that fits in with a certain kind of conception of what our relationship is to nature. That's recognizably biblical, it seems to me. And this guy, McIntosh, is not just an intelligent design theorist, he's actually a young earth creationist as well. Okay? And he's professor of thermodynamics at Leeds. And these and this research that he does in biomimetics is actually funded by our major state-based research council in this area. So this is respectable science that's being done. And of course, he doesn't write about intelligent design theory in his scientific or engineering articles. But nevertheless, you know, you can sort of see how these things are together. And how do you see this? Well, this has to do, I think, with knowing something about the history and philosophy of science, and in particular, what the scientific revolution was about. And when we talk about the scientific revolution, we typically hone in on the fact that it's about the mechanical worldview becoming kind of prominent. And the question becomes, well, what exactly is this mechanical worldview? Why do we talk about it? Well, I mean, I think the simplest way to understand it is the idea that we start to think about the universe as a big machine. Okay? And this is, in a way, you might say, is this trivial or might be wrong or whatever, but it's a very interesting kind of move to make. Because almost all cosmologies have some idea of a creator, right? But typically the creator moves in ways that is mysterious to the beings that are involved, right? So in other words, however the creator creates, it's not like, or it's not just a larger version of what human beings do. However, when you start to think about the universe as a machine, right? And the machine is quite obviously a human artifact, right? Then you're sort of changing the ball game in a way, right? You're sort of saying, and this becomes a kind of motivating factor to say, well, maybe, you know, just like we can design these machines, you know, according to these principles with, you know, these degrees of complexity and so forth, well, maybe the universe is kind of just a very large version of that. Okay, and the scientific revolution was basically about accepting that move. Okay, and that's more than just accepting there's a creator, but that the creator is of a certain kind. God's a big engineer. Okay. Now, how is this possible? Well, there's been a lot of work done in the history and philosophy of science, and one of the things that people talk about, to bring in a little philosophy here, is this idea of univocal predication. Okay. And this is the idea that the kinds of the attributes that we make about God, so we say God is all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good, blah, 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 right, that the sense in which we're using the words powerful, knowing, and good is the same sense, univocal, right, as when we talk about human beings, except that God's an infinitely extended version of that. In other words, it's not a qualitative difference between us and God, it's a quantitative difference. Okay? And that's very important for the scientific revolution as a motivation for people to start going on this kind of trip of progress, right, where what does progress do? We get closer and closer to understanding ultimate reality, where you can measure how far we're going. Because there's a sense in which our minds are different from God's mind only by matters of degree, not kind. Okay? Now, this is a very important kind of move. And univocal predication is something that in the Middle Ages is put forward by John Duns Scotus and is generally kind of something, if you think about the two great orders of the Middle Ages, the Dominicans and the Franciscans are on this trip. Okay, and Scotus responding to Aquinas, because Aquinas holds a somewhat different view of predication, which depending on whether you're Protestant or Catholic, you either call it equivocal or analogical. Analogical is the more polite name. And the idea here is that in some sense, when we say that God is all good, we don't just mean that God is a sort of better version of us, but that there's a sense in which good only applies to a certain extent in the way that we normally understand it, but then there are these other senses of good that we don't quite understand. So there is a kind of qualitative break. And so that's why we call it sometimes analogical. Some properties match up. Some of our properties are like God's properties, some of them aren't. Okay. Now, but this kind of view gets pushed aside in the scientific revolution. Now, why is this? Well, one of the things about Protestantism that's quite interesting is it's a kind of back-to-the-Bible movement. And so people start reading the Bible for themselves and take that as authoritative in the way it hadn't been in Catholicism. And one of the things they figure out is they read Genesis and say, we're creating the image and likeness of God. What does that mean? Well, you know, this is where univocal predication say, well, if we're creating the image and likeness of God, then we're sort of God-like. And we know kind of what we do, and we know what we do well, and so forth, and so God must be kind of a bigger, better version of that. And once you start thinking that way, the scientific revolution is off and running, basically. Okay. Now, there are all kinds of problems you run into. You run into problems with theological authorities and the English Civil War and all the stuff that you know happens in the 17th century as well. But basically, to get people thinking in this way that leads to the scientific revolution, you have to have this kind of conception of the relationship between God and humans, and this is one where God is the big engineer, just like we're engineers, God's the big engineer. And then you have to think about, okay, what are the implications of that? And the implications of that start to get very interesting very quickly. Okay. Now, there is a book, I'm going to talk about a branch of theology now, called Theodicy. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this. Theodicy is the branch of theology that is concerned, we normally say, with the problem of evil. But really, generally speaking, it's the problem of imperfection. If you think about it, right, one of the arguments that are always used by Darwinists against intelligent design theory of creationism is, you know, if God created the world, why is everything so fucked up? Right, why is everything so bad? Why is there, you know, if nothing's, thing, you know, things, couldn't things be better? You know, got God up there, right? Couldn't it be better? Right? Now, the point is, this is not a new objection, right? This is, in a sense, something that the people who founded this discipline of theodicy knew right at the outset. These people weren't stupid, right? I mean, so they realized that there's a lot of death, there's a lot of pointless death, there's a lot of monstrosities in nature, natural catastrophes, right? There are all these things. If God is, in some sense, some big engineer who has designed the world, right, to be the best of all possible worlds, right, certainly in parts, for at least temporary periods of time, things don't look very good. So you have to figure out why, what's going on here. And so what you start to do is you start to get into this idea of optimization. Okay? That in a sense, when we say that this is the best of all possible worlds, right, we mean it in the whole. It's the best whole you can come up with, but that doesn't mean that each of the individual parts are themselves the best taken individually. Okay? Now, why does one come up with this view? Well, first of all, part of it is to save the phenomena, right? Namely, that you have all these monstrous deaths and catastrophes and things that you just can't say don't exist. They're there. So you have to say that somehow they're there for a reason, that they're somehow part of an optimal overall package, that you can't have, as it were, the good without the bad in this overall situation. Okay? But there are other reasons as well, and one of them has to do with biblical reasons. Namely, sort of a fact that struck people in the 17th century, kind of a difficult thing to kind of get their heads around, namely the idea that God takes time to create. It doesn't matter whether God did it in 6 days, 4,000 years, or 4 billion years. It doesn't matter. The fact is he took time at all. Right? That there's some sense in which one can make a distinction already in the Bible between God's intellect and God's will. Right, so in other words, God just doesn't think stuff into existence. God's got to try. He's got to put effort into it. He doesn't do it all at once. What's that about? Right? I mean, this is quite an important point because this becomes then an impetus for thinking that in some sense one might talk about being able to quantify divine agency. Right? And the quantification of divine agency, how does God actually act in the world, is a very influential concept in terms of motivating people to come up with what we, you know, concepts like gravity and inertia and all these sort of fundamental physical notions, where, as it were, the abstractness is often capturing things that, at least to Aristotle, would have seemed very counterintuitive about nature, just looking at the surface. But nevertheless, if you imagine it as part of a kind of overarching system, does start to make sense as fundamental principles. Okay. And again, see, the thing we always have to ask is, why do people even bother thinking this way before we actually know the benefits of doing so? Right? Because this is the thing that's really important. I think we always have to ask this about major intellectual breakthroughs, right? It's always easy to justify intellectual breakthroughs 100, 200 years downstream when we already have the benefits from it. You know, but the question is, how do you justify it at the time that so many people are captivated by this kind of project that yet has yet to pay off, and in fact is very controversial in many respects? And here I think the kind of theological vision of what kind of a God we believe in becomes very important, and it's the God as engineer. Okay, and that's very important. Now, theodicy turns out to be a very difficult kind of discipline to pursue, you might say. And there's a book that was published at the end of last year by the chair of the philosophy department at the University of Wisconsin, Stephen Nadler, who's a Spinoza scholar normally. Let me just put his name up there in case you want to follow that up. And the book is called The Best of All Possible Worlds. It's published, actually, by the big commercial publisher, Farrar, Straus, Giroux. Okay, so this is kind of a... And it was reviewed in the New York Times and all the rest of it. And basically, this book is about theodicy and about the debates going on between the main players in the late 17th century, all of whom are, in a way, respond. This is before Newton really gets dominance, and they're responding to Descartes, primarily. And this whole idea of... cogito ergo sum, they were interpreting this as Descartes' way of sort of reenacting God's thinking, okay? So we've got people like Malebranche, maybe some of you have heard of these guys, Antoine Arnauld, who is a kind of skeptic in this, he doesn't believe that it's possible to sort of figure out what God is up to, and of course the most famous man associated with all this is Leibniz. Leibniz coins the word theodicy as such, from the Greek divine justice, and it's one of his final books in 1710. Okay. This whole discussion is taking place basically because people are thinking, okay, if we're going to have this kind of new science from the scientific revolution, it's not going to be enough just to figure out how things work. We want to figure out why things work. And the way they understood the question of why, and Leibniz is very good on this point, is why this rather than any other world? So it's why in that sense, right? Namely, the why about the selection process. You know, why does God select to create this world rather than some other world? Now, once we figure that, you know, and then we also can talk about how God creates the world, and that's the normal laws of physics and stuff like that. But the question is, why do they have this character rather than this other character? And, you know, some of the discussions that you might know nowadays that take place in cosmology with the anthropic principle and so forth have a lot of this ring to it, right? If the physical constants were slightly different, we wouldn't be here to see what's going on, that kind of argument. Well, this is kind of the spirit in which this kind of project was being launched in the 17th century, right? So to understand why it is that this is the world we've got, right, we have to see how any other possible world would have been worse, perhaps because we wouldn't be there, okay? So that's the point. Now, if you look at the fine detail of what these people do when they're arguing about theodicy, Malebranche is probably the best person to read, actually. And there's a very interesting book by a historian of philosophy at the University of Bristol on Malebranche that Routledge published by a guy named Andrew Pyle, and where he has like lots of stuff excerpted and then commentary. You find that the kinds of arguments for theodicy... that God, in fact, is designed the world in special purpose kinds of ways, look very much like contemporary arguments for intelligent design. Okay. That the parts have to be functionally interrelated in a certain kind of way, and if they were any different, then the thing wouldn't be able to exist as it is. Now, the candidates for this aren't bacteria flagellum and this kind of stuff that we talk about nowadays, intelligent design, but rather the heart. Right? But the heart has to be, the heart seems like a very strange-looking object. You know, it's quite clear what its function is. Why is it constructed exactly in this way? Well, Malebranche would have like a whole chapter talking about this. If it were any different, it wouldn't work. Okay. And so this is something that's very much part of the tradition that comes out of the scientific revolution, part of the theological vanguard, you might say. But then this tradition disappears. I think that's, in a sense, that's kind of... How much more time do I have?
10.
Okay, because in a way, the disappearance or the downgrading of this question, I think, is quite important, and Darwin's particular role in this, because as you move from the 17th into the 18th centuries, you might say people become increasingly imaginative about how to justify all kinds of awful things as being part of God's will. So that, in fact, this phrase that we use a lot, the end justifies the means, was originally applied to God. Okay, God's got this end, and he'll just do anything he can to get this perfect state going, even if it means cutting lots of corners and so forth with people's lives and things of that kind. And so if you fast forward to the end of the 18th century, one of the last major theodicists is a guy by the name of Thomas Malthus, who you may know of in another guise, okay? But Thomas Malthus is this Protestant theologian, right? And one of the things that had happened over the course of the 18th century was that theodicy became part of the sort of ordinary discourse of European culture, and so one of the places where it really flourished was political economy. And political economy, in a way, is the, I would say, is the ultimate recipient of this entire line of thinking, right? And if you think about the way in which economists justify things these days, right, all kinds of abominations can kind of be justified because, you know, in the long run, all this will kind of work itself out in some sort of fashion, right? Well, this was originally the kind of argument that was used to justify how God designs the world. He'll allow a certain amount of badness and suboptimality in the short run or in the local area, but overall this contributes to this kind of larger optimal picture. Okay, and this migrated very much into political economy, and Malthus very specifically applied it to issues of population, okay, where the idea was that if you have a surplus of people being produced, and you have, you know, vis-a-vis the amount of resources that are available to feed them, right, what you basically do is you starve the waste product. It's a way of, it's a sort of sorting process, or what Darwin would call natural selection, right? So that the people who aren't fit to survive won't survive, and so in a way you can use death as a selection mechanism. And that's why there is so much death going on in Europe in the late 18th century. It's for that reason. And one of the people who really buys into this argument big time is a guy named William Paley. Those of you who follow the intelligent design debate will know William Paley is usually used as the great guru of intelligent design. You want to go to the past and you want to think of some sort of theorist who backed intelligent design theory, you go to William Paley, because his book, Natural Theology in 1802, was the book that Darwin read, right, that inspired him to go into natural history, because natural theology is basically a kind of intelligent design explanation for all of nature. And so you get all kinds of very detailed accounts of how all kinds of organisms and parts of organisms are designed in various clever kinds of ways, more than would seem apparent to the naked eye. Okay, but then there's this chapter 26 in natural theology called The Goodness of the Deity. And the goodness of the deity is about Malthus. And Malthus is being praised, because Malthus has kind of solved a fundamental problem of theodicy. How is it possible that God could allow this massive death and so forth to occur? You see? But obviously what God wants to do is he wants to figure out a way of getting better humans. Okay? Now, Charles Darwin read this, and there's all this correspondence of, you know, Darwin with other people concerning Malthus, and Malthus was quite clearly a formative influence. He was reading him when he was on the Beagle. And with regard to the concept of natural selection, Malthus is the main intellectual influence, no doubt about it. But one of the consequences of buying Malthus was, it wasn't that Darwin therefore came to believe God didn't exist, but rather a God worth worshiping didn't exist. And that's a key point. Okay. That's the key point, because as you know, Darwin never denies the existence of God. But what's quite clear is God doesn't worship God. I mean, that Darwin doesn't worship God. Okay, there may be this God who does these things, you know, and that Malthus may in fact be defined in a way talking about divine agency when he talks about natural selection. But if that's the case, that's not a God worth believing in or worshiping. And that's what Darwin's final position turns out to be. Okay. And this is a very interesting point, because it's not, you know, and if you see, if you look at some of Darwin's very close descriptions, like the way in which the eye evolves and stuff like that, very often what he's doing is he's taking Paley's descriptions and respinning them a little bit. So Paley has a description about the eye, you know, as developing through gradual processes, blah, blah, not so different. Not so different. So it's,
it's not that Darwin is coming up with new facts necessarily that people like Paley and all these other religiously inspired thinkers didn't come up with. So it's not like Darwin had some kind of like knockdown empirical argument against intelligent design theory, but it's rather that if you conceptualize all of the local imperfections of nature in terms of the way in which organisms and species are defined, that it becomes very difficult to imagine some kind of overall optimal package that this could be serving. Okay? And as you know, Darwin's theory of evolution is not a theory of evolution as progress. Right? He doesn't believe that we're heading anywhere. He doesn't believe there's any goal. He doesn't believe there's any truth or any ultimate state that we're heading toward, except extinction, of course. Okay? And to me, it seems to me, this is kind of the problem that people who want to support intelligent design theory and do it, as it were, for theological reasons, and because they sort of believe they're created in the image and likeness of God, and they're sort of attracted to the idea that God is a big engineer and all the rest of it. It's not that it doesn't fit the facts, okay? I think you can actually make it fit the facts in quite interesting sorts of ways. And in fact, we still talk about optimization and functionality and all these things in biology. And this is residues of this kind of original theological discourse, no matter how much people want to deny it. We wouldn't be talking this way if that old theological discourse wasn't there. But then the question becomes, what does God look like? What does God look like in this kind of picture, which allows so much depth, so much suboptimality, so much imperfection, to pass as part of the design features of nature? What's the point? What's the overarching goal? Right? What end could possibly be served by so much of an, so many imperfect means, right? And that's the kind of, it's a theological issue. And so, I was saying before that theodicy died. The main reason why theodicy died wasn't the intellectual arguments, okay? But it was rather the lack of applicability to pastoral theology. You cannot, theology is not just about intellectual arguments to sort of rationalize the existence of the world, right? It's also about making people feel good about their lives, right? Making them feel like their lives are meaningful and stuff like that. That's part of what pastoral theology is about. And how can something like theodicy contribute to that? Right? If this is the best of all possible worlds, but it's one of those worlds which tolerates massive, unexplainable kind of death, how do you use that as a mode of consolation? Right? So it had no positive pastoral function. And that was the thing that really got theologians turned off to theodicy. So now theodicy is just kind of a boutique subject about evil in a very narrow kind of sense. Okay. But, I mean, I put all this forward because I do think that, I personally think it is a very attractive idea to think of God as a big engineer, actually. I think it's a very attractive idea. I think it's been historically a very motivating idea in terms of promoting scientific progress as far as it has gone. I think without that idea, you wouldn't have all this stuff. I think this kind of idea that we are sort of a small version of this kind of divine engineer is very potent. I think one of the ways you can see this, and as it were from a kind of negative standpoint, is if you know David Noble, some of you may know David Noble, sort of radical historian of science, a self-declared Luddite, who has this excellent book called The Religion of Technology that came out in 1997, The Divinity of Man and the Spirit of Invention is the subtitle. Right, and this book, in a way, catalogs the development of this mentality from the Middle Ages forward, and how it exists today. For example, especially in biotechnology, right? That's kind of the thing he sort of ends up with. And he's, of course, very negative and maybe even very paranoid about all this stuff. But I think he's making a very profound point about the intimate connection between God as the big engineer and this kind of impetus toward progress that often, happens quite blindly in the sense that all these disasters take place, but we still go forward. And I think, in the 21st century, this is something that we have to confront, I think, more directly. I think engineers, in a way, are in a good position to do so, and because we have a lot of vistas that are opening up for us in terms of how we can redesign nature and re-engineer nature and so forth. And how exactly we respond to that, especially in a world that is maybe not so inclined to believe in God as the big engineer. How do we justify that if we want to go there at all? Okay? And I'll stop there and take some questions.
Well, my questions would take an hour.
That's for sure.
So we delete those. I'm going to invite questions, and we'll have to be, Carl, we'll have to be reasonably quick in both asking and answering.
I really like that. I agree with a lot of that. But you told us at the beginning you were going to connect this with artificial intelligence.
No, I didn't say that. I didn't say artificial intelligence.
What did you say that you were going to connect it with?
Intelligent design.
Okay, I thought you were going to connect it.
No. So artificial intelligence...
You could connect it with artificial intelligence.
Yes, and Noble's book does, and sure, and that's another talk, but I don't...
Kevin Kellett has a Nerd Theology article in which he says that programmers see themselves as godlike.
Yeah, and I think that should be taken seriously. That's a good point you're raising. Because there's an issue about if we talk about what is the essence of being human, I think one of the open questions that we're going to be increasingly faced with is whether it requires our being confined to our carbon-based existence. Okay? Because I do think that this is a traditional notion, but of course if you read like Ray Kurzweil, people, the singularity is near, the uploading of consciousness into silicon chips and all the rest of that. However fanciful you may regard that now, nevertheless that is responding to, I think, part of this theological conception, namely that there's a sense in which, well, you know, if human beings are going to kind of get back in touch with God, we need to, you know, get rid of a lot of the stuff about our material existence, right, which may be sort of holding us back, you might say, from the fall and all this. And one of them might actually be the human body in some sense, okay? And so there's this interesting discussion that I think we are going to continue to have in the 21st century about where does the essence of the human lie, and to what extent can one radically transform the human body, you know, by adding stuff that is, you know, non-organic or whatever, and still consider it human, or maybe even progress on the human. I mean, you may know that there's all this stuff about, John Harris, who's the bioethicist at Manchester University, has recently written this book, Enhancing Evolution. You know, and he makes a lot of statements in the press all the time about, you know, taking brain-boosting drugs and prosthetic devices and retuning your brain every so often so you can be smarter, and that this, in fact, you know, is going to be the way to go, okay? And there are people who are moving, you know, transhumanists, right, are moving more and more in that sort of direction. And if you look at those people, what they're doing, right, they're in a sense making an argument that is old as the Franciscans, you know, in some sense that our bodies hold us back. Our bodies hold us back from full spiritualization of, you know, spiritual realization of God. And so it's not surprising these people end up, when they start really elaborating this stuff in some kind of philosophical depth, they start sounding theological. Yeah, I think it's a very, and I think that's something, you know, one should really keep a sharp eye on, it seems to me.
Another question. Mrs. Mitchell.
Isn't it just Western people who think of God as the big engineer?
Mm-hmm.
What are the implications?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think, I do think that's right. And I think that,
when people make that argument to me, I think the key point here is, if one thinks about the scientific revolution, the interesting aspect of it isn't necessarily the concepts or the techniques per se, because you can actually find precedents of these things in other cultures at other times. That's not really the issue. The issue is the drive to make it a kind of all-consuming project that takes up all of humanity and lasts generation after generation after generation and has this kind of indefinite duration for it. Okay, and that's where I think that the Western theology, the salvation story essentially, becomes very essential, is for that kind of move. Because of course, for limited periods of time, you do find, you know, in the Greek culture, Chinese culture, whatever, you do find very advanced forms of science and technology and so forth, but the issue is staying power, right? Especially staying power in spite of disasters, in spite of, you know, like, why didn't World War I or World War II end science and technology? Why not, right? I mean, that's interesting, it didn't.
But it didn't end Buddhism either, so.
it's really very, very always great to hear you, see you. And I think, you know, it's a sort of a very important, I would say it's one side. You know, the title of your talk was The Struggle for the Soul of Engineering. And you could say this is sort of one side of the struggle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is to actually continue to refer what you're saying is the sort of underlying meaning of the scientific revolution, what we call in our book hubris.
Exactly.
This
Faust. The Faustian image.
You know, the mission impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, you know, to always see the task as doing something that hasn't been done before. Mm-hmm. All of these kinds of very, very powerful, you know, throughout human history, and I would say not just in Western civilization.
But the staying power is very important about Western.
But the other thing, but then who's on the other side? Who is this struggling with? You know, and I think, you know, in a sense, the whole need to think in terms of, you might say, taming what we call taming the hubris, you know, in some sense, is the other side
sure.
of the struggle. You know, and then it becomes so important also, I think, to identify, you know, some of the deep cultural roots of that struggle,
yeah.
you know, which I call hybrids. You
yeah.
know, which is sort of taking this incredible creative energy and turning it to some kind of social.
Oh, I agree. And
you know, and it's just sort of wondering how you sort of see this in relation.
Yeah,
to that.
Well, well, I do think that, see, in the monotheistic religions, because, as it were, all human beings are created in the image and likeness of God, there's a kind of implicit democratization. The fact that at particular points in time, only a few human beings are able to exercise all this creative power and often end up subjugating the other human beings, that has always been, you can always use, you always had a normative resource to criticize that, right? Because in a sense, you're not living up to the universalist ideal of everyone being created in the image and likeness of God. So in that sense, monotheism is very important as a kind of backdrop, right? Because it's not a survival of the fittest thing. It's not like, you know, everything and everybody can be creative and whoever gets there first wins kind of thing. No, that's not how it works, right? It's the idea that there's a prior understanding that everyone's been created this way. And so if everyone's not actually able to exercise that creative energy, there's a problem, right? And that's where all the social justice issues and stuff start to come in.
There's sort of built-in accountability procedures.
Yeah, right? Yeah, but that's right. But that too has a theological root, right? That's the point. I mean, that's also very...
Okay, two very quick questions. Steen and then Carr.
Yeah, I would like to ask you, how does Francis Bacon fit into this picture? And would you say that deism was a general religious attitude at the time? Because it seems to me that deism is the religious underpinning of what you're saying. Would that be right?
Well, I think basically what these people believed, a kind of Unitarian view, they had a very, you might say, a stripped-down view of God, you might say, right? I mean, so in other words, God has to be directly accessible to human beings. That's a very important point. I mean, so all the mystification surrounding the Holy Trinity, right, which Catholic theology was all bound up in, right, that in a way made it very difficult for human beings actually to even have pretense to get into the mind of God. You basically want a simple God, right, a God, you know, who's like a big version of us. And that's where things like Unitarianism and deism, right, which then enables you to have that kind of understanding of God, becomes very important.
But at the time, it seems to me that deism was conceived of as a kind of atheism.
Yeah, but see, but that's a different issue, right? That's anti-clericalism. And I think with all of this stuff that we're talking about here, right, the belief in God is separate from the, you know, obedience to the church, of any church, right? And it's true that deists and Unitarians and all sorts of other kinds of characters in that vein, right, basically were anti-clerical. No doubt about it. But it doesn't mean they didn't believe in God. Of course, they were called atheists by their opponents. But it's actually very hard to find people affirming atheism until relatively modern times. You know, people say, I don't believe in God, and I'm proud, you know. And that's why this kind of new atheism that's so fashionable now is very interesting. Right? Because all of a sudden now atheists have to cook up a worldview that didn't exist before. You know, like, what exactly is the positive idea of atheism? You know, that's not just libertarianism or something like that.
The last question, Carl.
I'll pass.
Okay, my wife has just talked to me in my ear, and she basically makes one comment.
She's talking to you in your ear?
So you think God, she's an engineer?
Uh-huh. Yes, I'm happy to. Yes, I'm happy to be the gender. Yeah. You got it.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We didn't lose any time on that session.
Excellent.
Like the other speakers, I'm very honored to
have been brought into this project, both first in Colorado.